This week, we're going to look at a topic that I recently gave a talk about in DC as part of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Conference in collaboration with Hostling International. And this is related to my book, The Six-Figure Travel Writing Roadmap, but also to a lot of conversations that I've had with folks for years and years about travel writing and what makes people able to do this as a full-time job. So when people started asking me to coach them as travel writers, I wasn't sure about it at first because I had had a lot of friends that I'd given advice to over the years, and I often didn't see that advice working out for them, but it wasn't necessarily that they tried the advice and didn't work. It was often because they just didn't try it. And so I wanted to go around and talk with some travel writers who were making it, as well as those who weren't doing what they had set out to do, and see really what was it that separated these two groups of people. The people who were calling themselves travel writers or travel bloggers but actually made their income through another source, and the people for whom being a travel writer is just their job. Today we're going to look at three different things. So first I want to look at some real hard numbers on freelance writing, and of course travel writing specifically, but I think there's a lot of this mentality with people who have a full-time job that's not travel writing, that, oh, you could just never earn a full-time living doing that, or I could never replace my salary. And even for people who've been doing it for a long time, you know, it's hard to imagine, if you feel like you've been trying everything you could, that there are better rates out there. So we're going to look at some numbers. And then we're going to look at the five things that I found to be the most valuable or important or defining traits of high-income travel writers. And then we're going to look at some ways that you can go off, write this today in the evening or this week or this month, and start to replicate those same habits so that you can have your own success. So before we start talking about this, I want to define, you know, success in a way that's not just financial for a minute. I want to talk about what it means to be a sustainable travel writer, to have a sustainable travel writing career. Because, you know, I think that a lot of people turn to this job, to the idea of traveling the world full-time and being a nomadic writer to get away from burnout and other types of jobs, but this is also a job that you can burn out in. And so when I talk about being a high-income travel writer, I want to really couch that I'm not necessarily saying that you need to be working 16-hour days every day to earn this money. The times that now, of course, I spend most of my time working in this business, but when I was a writer for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, I was actually working part-time pretty much that entire time. So to me, the ideal travel writer day on the road, it's different when you're at home, of course, is that, you know, you're not in the U.S. time zone, so you don't wake up to a bunch of emails. You maybe work on your computer from 10 a.m. or something until lunch, and then you go out and you walk around and you explore the city that you're in, and then you come back and you work a couple more hours, and then you go out for dinner again. And that is the schedule that I kept for a very, very long time. And part of the reason that that works, part of the reason that you can be a high-earning freelance writer, but especially a high-earning travel writer, and works a few hours, is that I'm sure you've all seen the studies of how few hours people who work typical 9-to-5 jobs actually work during the work week. It's usually less than 20 out of the 40 hours that they're actually doing quote-unquote work. I'm making air quotes here, and I realize you all can't see them. And so the thing is that when you, I don't want to say do it right, but when you have set up your freelance writing practice in an ideal way, you're able to work, you're able to spend those, whatever it is, 17.6 hours that you actually are working, and then doing other things like traveling with the rest of the time. And, you know, for a lot of folks, I know I have really bad health issues, a lot of other people do that follow us as well. This is actually really a boon because once you figure out the right balance for yourself in terms of the amount of time that you need to spend working on different tasks and you get to a point where you're writing very quickly, then this can actually be a really great type of part-time job as well. So let's look at some numbers. All right, there's a couple surveys that I drew these numbers from. This first one here is from, if any of you guys know Contently, which we've talked about on some of the other calls about travel content marketing writing, is a website that offers, it works as a third party between companies and writers to coordinate content marketing engagements. And I don't want to comment too much about them as a company or anything like that, but they have two fantastic, really, really fantastic blogs that I think are really game changers, and I don't use that word a lot. And if you are looking to read more about how to be a freelancer or what that lifestyle is like, I would really recommend their blog, The Freelancer, which has a lot of people's firsthand stories and tips from writers working in all different types of writing, of course, but they do have travel writing. And I think the reason that this is really useful is that because they have so many different types of writers contributing, as opposed to when you have a single person blog and that person might be a business writer or they might be a ghostwriter, you get a lot of different perspectives and great tips. And so on The Freelancer, they have been putting out this survey for a couple of years where they try to get as much as possible, because there's no association that every single independent writer belongs to. So as much as possible, they try to get a bird's eye view of the industry. And I was really heartened to see that in their last survey, the 2016 year-end survey, they found that 8% of respondents were earning over six figures. And the thing I found particularly fantastic about this was that they didn't separate out people who were full-time writers versus people who were only part-time writers. So, of course, I know I was just saying that you can earn a really great income working part-time, but I've noticed, and we'll talk about this a little bit on the next slide as well, that people who are doing it part-time on top of another job don't have the same income goals. So a full 40, I believe 41% of people in that survey did work part-time. And so when you look at the overall breakdown of income, there's 41% of people who work part-time. So if we were to take those out and that leaves 6%, that makes this 8% of people who are earning over six figures a much larger chunk of the people who are working full-time. And as I said, they have writers of all different stripes, you know, financial and healthcare and different things. But I think that that's really encouraging, because when I remember before my book came out, I was sitting with, I won't name his name, but I was sitting with someone who's been in the industry for a very long time. He's been an editor at National Geographic, and we were passing around options for my book cover, and he said, six-figure travel writing, that's ballsy. He didn't say it was impossible, but he just said, that's ballsy. And now, you know, I find six-figure travel writing as a concept coming up on blogs all over the place. So it's not impossible. People are doing it. And if you read the newsletter or the blog post about the webinar this week, I actually had somebody write me. I was doing a talk in another city, and I sent out the invites, and she said, I'm already a six-figure travel writer, but I'd be super curious to hear about what you have to say. So these people are out there, and it is possible, and I would love for us all to have more role models in this way, and so I'm looking to bring more of their stories to you. But so I just want to start with this, that it's increasingly common, I would almost say, for people to earn six figures as a freelance writer. Now here's the crazy number. So ConvertKit, which is a company that does email marketing, so they run newsletters and things like that, they put together a survey this year of bloggers, because I know sometimes we talk about doing content marketing writing as in blogging for companies, and we talk a lot about writing for magazines because we have the travel magazine database, but some of you have your own blogs and that's your main thing, and when you write for magazines, that's sort of an additional income stream on top of your blog. And I was completely blown away to see in the survey the average, this isn't salary or income, this is profit, of the professional bloggers that they had surveyed was $138,000. So that's profit, so that's after expenses, guys. So when I say that this is possible and I'm going to share with you the secrets of six-figure travel writers, I really just want to make it clear that this, it's not an unattainable goal or something that's one in a million. You really just have to sort of follow the steps and do the work, and you can get there as well. So I have a couple different things on the blog and also in the book, it's the same breakdowns, ways of looking at how exactly as a travel writer you can make six figures. And so I just wanted to go over those quickly to show that you can really do it either with a lot of different little things or a couple large things and hit that six-figure number. So if you break down $100,000 over the 12 months of the year, then you end up with $8,333.33 and so on. So I've rounded that off to $8,500 per month. And I've put together these three breakdowns, depending on what is important to you, of how to earn six figures as a freelance travel writer. And so, again, I say depending on what is important to you, because that sustainability element is really important. I'm not going to talk about it when I go through the five things that define freelance travel writers who are very successful, but having the motivation to keep at it is the single biggest thing that separates people who are making any kind of success, forget about very high income success, from the people who just aren't achieving their travel writing goals. So making sure that you're doing work that's a fit for you as a person in terms of interest geographically or topically, sure, but in terms of your the type of work that you want to be doing is very, very important. So this first one that I have up here is travel writers who value their freedom. So this is people who are perhaps nomadic or you have your own blog, and you want to have work where you don't have a lot of email back and forth with the client or the editor, and you really are essentially are doing it almost like a project in that you're managing the whole process and then you just deliver something. And so you can do that with just one copywriting gig a month where you're doing things for a website. And either you're doing a very, very large website writing project where you're doing it over the course of several months and it's broken out, or you can do one different project per month. I've had people come to me for something that was going to be a one-month project for $6,500 that just came to me out of the blue, like just through my website. So these things are totally out there, and copywriting is actually one of the higher paying types of travel writing for sure in terms of base rates. I mean, you can certainly get more writing for magazines at a very high level, but in terms of base rates for copywriting, they're quite high. And then I recommend for digital nomads complementing that with something where you are writing blog posts for a company or for a tourism board or something like that, and perhaps also doing the content management, so you're doing the editorial strategy for a couple different clients. So in here I have three clients of 1,500, but again, I say conservatively on both of these numbers, and all the numbers that we've included in these breakdowns are conservative, because you can certainly get more for any of these types of work, and you can certainly get less. And the thing that we have talked about in the previous webinar on pricing is that if you're new, not to writing, or sorry, to not to travel per se, but to writing. So if you really need to hone your skills, it's perfectly okay to take lower rates. Don't take all the people who say, oh, you should never get paid $25 for a blog post, that's insulting, blah, blah, blah. If you are new and you need editing and you need that level of mentorship from the editor, start low until you get confidence in clips, okay? So the numbers that I have in here are all conservative. They're a snapshot of what can be earned. So for travel writers, though, who really want to be writing for magazines, how do you reach six figures? I have had a lot of people who do focus on magazines tell me that they think either that that's impossible or that they've been doing this for 25 years and now they earn less than they did before. And this is it is an issue of magazines paying less or that the rates just aren't going up. I haven't necessarily have any magazines that I work with lower their rates, but they don't raise them very quickly. I definitely have had people say, hey, we're just going to bump you up another X cents. But if you want to earn all of your income from writing for magazines and you really care about the bylines, having your name on everything, this is really a good strategy for folks who have either they're book authors or they teach or they're career journalists from a different field who are switching into travel writing. And I've certainly seen people come from other types of writing and get very high income assignments very quickly. So here's another area where the numbers are pretty conservative. So I've set in here a feature article with a newsstand magazine at $3,000. So the thing with newsstand magazines is that they do pay a dollar a word, and they do pay more than a dollar a word. And if you're doing, and I'm not saying that we're all going to run out and get these tomorrow, but if you had a feature assignment for Condé Nast Traveler, you are going to get a very large chunk of change for that. And so I have on here to have one of these, but in reality, it's not necessarily that you're going to be having one feature article exactly every single month. And something that we didn't look at here is this concept of feast or famine. And I know this comes up a lot, that you know some months you have tons of work and other months you have don't, that you don't have very much at all, and we're going to look at how to even that out down the line. But keep in mind with these snapshots, I saw somebody had a question about this, that this is, you know, kind of an idealized breakdown of things that, you know, certainly occur at these rates, but you're not necessarily going to be able to line up exactly one of these things or two of these things every month unless it's a recurring contract. So to go back to these breakdowns, so when you are trying to write primarily for magazines, you can also get, like I said, features. You're not necessarily going to get a big, huge, juicy feature every month. But what you can do is you can get departments. So departments are also called columns. And these are the things that happen in, let's say, the back of the front of the book. So before you get to the features, but after the short, newsy sort of things that are only around 200 words, there's these really nice sections that often I've seen them these days. They get longer and longer. I've seen them go up to 1,500 words. I've even seen a couple that are 2,000 words. And these are often $1 a word. And this was actually one of the first glossy magazine assignments that I got myself, was for a niche title, but from a large publishing house. And it was for 1,000 words and for $1,000 and another $1,000 for the photos. So you can certainly get these as a new writer. And then once you have been at it for a while and you have relationships with editors, you can often get the same department in the same magazine. So that is where it gets easier to project that you're going to be able to check each of these boxes every month. And then, like I was saying, there's a lot of these shorter pieces. And the thing that's nice about these shorter pieces is that once you have a relationship with an editor, it's really easy to say, hey, I just got back from blah, and I found this great museum that's opening around this really famous artist that nobody knows is there. And to get these short front of book things be pitches that only take you one sentence to write to editors that you already know. Now, the other one that I have in here that I jumped over for a second is a newspaper article or a travel essay for a mainstream publication online. So, again, with these, the rates really vary. But the thing that I want to say here is that it's really important every time you take a trip to maximize it as much as possible. The people who are really successful, they're not just going on a trip and writing, you know, a couple things for their blog or some other websites and one big feature about it. In fact, I spoke to somebody in London who told me that he typically comes home and tries to write up to 12 different assignments from the same trip right away, and that he aims to write about every place he's traveled at least 3 times. And I think that is a good way to look at it. And when we do our workshops, we really look at breaking out, you know, not just 5 or 10, but like 50, 200 ideas from each trip that you take. Because that's how, when you're sending those all out as pitches, if you're getting a 25% acceptance rate, which is really pretty middle of the road for people who, you know, haven't spent a ton of time polishing their pitches but have been at it for a while, then you're going to get a great number of assignments back from that trip. Okay, so let's look at the last type of motivation. So for travel writers who value free trips. So I have this in here because it's kind of a catch-22, right? A lot of people think that when they start out as travel writers, you know, that the travel is its own reward. And I don't just mean the travel writers themselves, but I also mean the people inviting you on the trips. I'm sure we all know about those sort of trips, right? And so I want to note here that you can maximize your travel to be free without just relying on press trips and still make a good amount of money. And the way to do this, and a lot of times, goes to what we talked about in the last few weeks, which is content marketing. And you can do a neat little angle on this. So you can go to a tourism board or a tour company and say, hey, like for 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to go around and do all this stuff. And then I'm going to give you, you know, blog posts for a year and social media updates and this, that, and the other thing. And that's the one that I have on here at the top. And you can really do this as a project-based rate, but then break the payments up over a couple different months. So that's the kind of thing that makes it really easy for you to schedule what kind of income you're going to have coming in. And then what you do is, once you have that anchor, that thing that you know is going to have income and also that has you travel to an interesting place, then you can take that and then break that out into places that you're pitching either features that you can write on your own very easily for lower paying niche or regional publications, or, you know, things that you're writing maybe for websites as essays if you are somebody who really wants to be working on your essays. But the other thing is that I think we often forget, like when we go on these trips, this editorial distinction that needs to happen. So I've had people ask me, you know, oh, I was on this trip and this person asked me to do their blog. What should I say? So if you've gone on a trip, a press trip or a visit of some sort that's supposed to be editorial, and then you're asked to do work for that place, to cover that place for money, do make sure, if that's the order, that it was an editorial trip and then the request. do make sure that your editorial is completed before you begin doing any paid work by the company. And when I say completed, I don't just mean that you've written it, but also that it's been published. So do make sure if you're pursuing this path that that's what you do. All right, so let's look at these five factors that I talked about that separate the really successful high-income travel writers from everybody else. So the first one I touched on a little bit earlier when we were looking at the income breakdowns, and this is that they have recurring income. And, you know, I get a lot of people, especially who focus on journalism, saying, well, like, oh, you know, how do I do that? Or, you know, sometimes my editor just doesn't need anything from me. Or, oh, does that mean that I should teach? And there's really a lot of fish in the sea, both in terms of publications and in terms of things that you can write about. And like I was saying, we just hit the 300th magazine in the travel magazine database. But that's just a drop in the bucket. And I swear, even when I think, you know, I have a list of 2,000 magazines or something that we've compiled in the six-figure travel writing roadmap book and that we use also as a free giveaway, and I'm always finding more. It really just boggles my mind how many publications are out there, print publications, forget about even web publications, that are every single month having to fill their pages with content. And then when you look at web publications, right, like there's the web publications that are related to print publications. For instance, Men's Journal runs 8 to 12 things on its website every day that are travel related. So there's really a lot there, and we'll get into that in a second. And the second thing, it's about the numbers, and not just what I was talking about earlier in terms of what numbers are possible, but keeping an eye on yours. And I'd love to just see like a sort of digital show of hands over here. How many of you have an income goal that you track and make sure that you are actually meeting it every month, or at least check in, and if you're not meeting it, try to do something about it? Let me know over here in the question box, because I'd love to see the level of where everybody is with that before I go into that bullet point further down. And then the other thing that I see is people not just pitching more in terms of more often, but also really taking the time to work on their pitch emails, whether it's doing some sort of education program, like coming to one of our retreats, or I didn't see any sessions on this when I was at the Association of Writing Programs conference, but I think there are some things out there. There's definitely some more general freelancing things. But people who have a high income aren't just pitching more. They're not just writing more emails. They're making sure that those emails are effective. And that does circle back to the point that I had above about tracking. So the next thing that I really found is that they're fearless, but not necessarily in reality, but at least in terms of getting things done. And this is related to pitching. I mean, obviously, if you're going to pitch more, even if you haven't heard back from any editors at all, then you've got to have some chutzpah. But I think part of this is also just being calm with that fact that this is how it is, that you don't hear back, and moving forward. And we'll get more into that in a second. And then the last point that I've seen is really always learning. And so I mentioned this lovely lady that I had written to in Boulder, and how she was like, yeah, I'm already earning six figures, but I'd love to hear what you have to say. And this mentality of constant improvement is another thing that's very, not particular too, but that I see in almost all of the really high earning freelance travel writers that I've spoken to. So let's go into these in some more detail. What kind of recurring gigs can you get? So I'd love also in the chat box, if people have recurring income set up already, let me know, because there might be some ways that I haven't even thought of that you're doing that would be great for other people on the call to know about. And in the meantime, while you guys are putting that in there, I'm just going to look at some other questions here. So yes, so the income breakdowns earlier that I included were per month, and we're going to go over analytics and how to analyze your marketing efforts in a little bit. Okay, so for recurring gigs, so we talked in the last month about how to do this with travel content marketing writing. And one of the things that's nice about that is that when you are reaching out to companies and making your own contracts, you're setting the payment terms. You're telling them that you need to be paid on the first of the month before your work has been completed. And they say, okay. I've actually never, ever actually had somebody tell me no to that. That's not a point in negotiations that actually comes up. It's very normal for writers who are doing big writing projects like copywriting, website things, to be paid half up front. And so I find companies don't really have a problem with if having that base ability to pay your bills. For instance, if you aren't nomadic and or you live in the US or Europe in an expensive country and you have rent that is not negligible that needs to be paid, this bedrock of recurring gigs is really important. And I find that the content marketing side, like I said, is really great because you know that they're going to be paid up front. But what if you want to write for magazines? So this came up when we did this talk in DC, that what do you do when the magazine pays on publication? And this was somebody who is sort of newer to travel writing that asked this question. And in case there's some folks on the call that don't know the difference, there's basically two types of pay when you're writing for magazines. There's pay on acceptance and pay on publication. And what that means is if you are paid on acceptance, it means that the editor gets your article, they give you some edits, you do some edits, and then they decide it's done. That means it's accepted. And at that point, you send them an invoice, and then you get paid some amount of time after when you've sent that invoice. Sometimes it's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 15 days, it depends on the publication. And paid on publication means that you are paid that same number of days, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, what have you, from when the article is printed. And so another small aside about publication timetables, so even if you're working with a very fast-moving trade magazine, articles usually are accepted no less than 1 month before they're going to go to print. In extreme, extreme circumstances, maybe 2 weeks, but I don't think that any of you would be in that situation. So that's the minimum. Sometimes they're accepted 6, 9 months. I've even heard 18 months before they're published. So getting paid on publication is a crappy, 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 crappy thing that none of us ever want to have happen. And so what I advised the person who asked this question when we did this talk in DC was to do one of two things. Either just don't work with a magazine that pays on publication, or to put it in the slush category of income. So when I say the slush category, what I mean is that you know how much money you need to earn, and 50% of that, 60% of it, whatever makes you happy, you need to know that it is absolutely going to be coming in a certain month. And then there's another 20-30% that you think is probably going to come in that month. So that means that, you know, maybe it's an editor that you work with often and you think that you'll probably get this assignment from them in this time period, and you know that they pay, you know, on acceptance in 30 days. So you can put in your little spreadsheet, and we're going to talk about those in a minute, but you can put in your little spreadsheet that you will receive, you know, $850 for that article in this time frame. And then the slush part, this little part on top, which is depending on your level of comfort, you know, 10 to 30% of your income projections, those are the things that you just don't know. And that is where you stick these things that pay on publication, where you don't have a firm date of when it's going to go to print. Now, the reason that I say this and that I harp a little bit about pay on publication is that there's a lot of big magazines with splashy names that you want to get published in that only pay on publication and that will push your article out. And when I say they will push your article out, I'm talking, you know, perhaps in the time frame of years here, okay? And I just recommend as a policy that you do not spend a lot of time when you don't have your base income needs met worrying about those publications for this reason, because you need to know where that money is coming from to have a sustainable income in terms of emotional sustainability, you know, not fighting with your spouse or where the money is coming from, and also emotional sustainability in terms of not stressing out, being able to sleep, being healthy, have healthy stress levels. So the point of recurring gigs is to allow you the mental freedom to be able to work on bigger and better things. And we're going to talk more, maybe not later this month, but next month, about being productive and balancing your income in these different ways. So that was a little bit about magazines. But in terms of recurring gigs that you can get, there's online has opened up so many great types of recurring travel writing opportunities. And I think, you know, we go on websites that list jobs, and of course I send out a weekly list of travel writing jobs in our newsletter. And, you know, the rates of what you see online can sometimes be abysmal, but I'm often surprised. And so I want to let you know that if you feel like you're not ready to be cold pitching companies to be doing their blogs, or maybe you don't want to be doing that type of work, that you really can still go online and find some decent things. I mentioned in the newsletter this week that I had one of these companies like Contently, that's like a third-party content, you know, intermediary, come to me with a gig that was almost a dollar a word for some really easy writing for a company. So these things certainly exist. And some of the ones in terms of the particular opportunities online that I recommend that are good to know that you're going to have recurring income, some other ones that are good are ghostwriting is a really good one. Ghostwriting is when you don't get a byline, because often you don't really care about having a byline on these type of pieces, to write something for a company or an individual. And there's some sort of sneaky ways that I think people don't realize that ghostwriting exists. So a lot of trade magazines, and in travel, there are a lot of different trade magazines. There's trade magazines for travel agents. There's trade magazines for people who work in all sorts of different areas of hospitality. There's trade magazines for aviation. These have columns in the front of the magazine that are theoretically written by some bigwig in the industry. And sometimes that person has the same column every month. Sometimes that section is written by a different contributor every month. But it might shock you that those things, not only are not written by those people often, but that some writer somewhere is getting paid to ghostwrite that column to make that person look good. So there's some surprising opportunities to ghostwrite things regularly that also allow you to learn about the space. And then one other one that I wanted to touch on is hotel reviewing. This is an interesting one. So there's a lot of different websites, and I know, of course, Forbes has a very well-known guide. It's kind of like the Michelin guide for hotels. There's a lot of different, very well-established in the business travel community, websites that focus on hotel reviews and have just a huge database, like we do with the magazine database, of hotels that need to be updated every year. So it's like a guidebook in that way. And so what happens with these is if you work with these companies, then you get a pool of hotels that you are charged with. You get a whole country, basically. So you might get, you know, the country of France for this for 2017, and you need to go and visit 87 different hotels and check on them all. And so what that means is that the time that you'll be spending, or rather the nights that you'll be sleeping doing these hotel reviews, and probably getting there, are footed, the bill is footed by this company that's paying you to do the hotel reviews. And then you're also getting paid something for the hotel reviews. But then that's sort of your anchor that gets you to this place, and then you can also find some other stories and sell them as well. And I know some people who are very well established now that this was the linchpin of their travel writing income when they started out. So if you have any other questions about recurring gigs, drop them in the side over here, and I'm going to move on to the next one. So if you don't know where you're going, how will you get there? What is your income goal? I mean, we can say, oh, I want to earn enough to quit my job. I want to earn enough that I can hire an assistant. I want to earn enough that, you know, I can get a babysitter so I can have more time to work and be less stressed out when I'm with my kids. And it's different for everybody what that magic number is that you need. You know, the topic of this talk is six figures, and people really like 100,000. It's a nice round number. But as I showed, when you break it down per month, 8,333, it's not such a round number. So people often like to choose numbers that make sense to them on a monthly level or on a yearly level. I know, like, for instance, $60,000, which breaks out into $5,000 a month. That's a nice round number. But figure out what is the number for you. And then here's the real trick. So besides just setting the goal, okay, making sure that you reach it is what keeps it from looking too big. So say you have only in the previous year, let's create a scenario. So unless somebody has one, feel free if you have a scenario of your background. I won't use your name, and I can share it with everybody in terms of income. But in the meantime, I'll just make one up. So say that you quit your job, or that you're industry was downsized, and so you decided, you know what, I really love travel, I'm going to sell my stuff and be nomadic and go to some cheaper countries, and I'm going to make a go of this. And your first year, you know, through a lot of different hustling and doing low-paid writing gigs and just sort of picking up what you could, you managed to get in the, like, high teens or, like, low 20,000s. This is very not uncommon. This is a very good, in fact, number if you're really just starting out from zero knowledge. But then the next year, you're like, well, if that was how much I made this year, what can I make next year? Can I only say I'm going to make 30? I don't like that number. That doesn't sound like a good goal. You can completely say that you are going to jump from 18,000 or 23,000 up to 40,000, 48,000, 45,000. And here's why. So now that you have that expertise, you set your monthly number. Let's say it's 4,000. Okay, how does that break down? There's 20 odd work days in the month. So let's just say 20. So that means that every day you need to be earning $200. So what that means is that you have in your calendar or in your Google or your paper calendar, whatever, you have that written at the end of the day. Did I earn $200 today? And at first that looks a little scary. $200, that's like, you know, eight $25 blog posts, or, you know, that's half of this feature article that I'm working on, but I know the feature article is going to take me a while. So at first that number sits there on your calendar every day and it just kind of scares you. Like at 7 p.m. or whatever time you stop working, you have this little pop-up. Did you earn $200 a day? And I used to do this when I first started freelance writing, when I lived in California for a little while before we moved to New York. I had a little thermometer, like, you know, those ones that they have for fundraising campaigns, like in schools or a blood drive or something like that. They have this little thermometer and they fill it up every time they reach another level. And so I would sit there during the day and I would block off like a certain part of my thermometer and I would shade it in and I would say, okay, this is for writing this blog post. This is for writing this blog post. And I found that over time, I had to change the scale on my thermometer. And so what happens is that as you have that reminder, as every day you look at that bottom line and say, I didn't earn any money today. Okay, tomorrow, what am I going to do to make sure that I'm earning this money? As you have that reminder that pushes you to hustle, that pushes you to complete an assignment, rather than sitting there thinking about how you're going to work on the structure of the feature, to complete that writing and get it out the door so you can start pitching something else, over time, those reminders not only stop being necessary, but what you find is that you're not just trying to meet that $200 a day. Now you're looking at, okay, if I have to earn $1,000 this week, what does that mean? That means I have to write one department. Oh, but I already did that, and it's only Tuesday. So what else can I do to be earning $2,000 this week? And your scale starts to change over time. So somebody had a question earlier about analytics and marketing efforts. And I also want to talk about this here, because there's the very sort of nitty-gritty factual tracking of, did I earn money or not, and why? And I recommend, you know, if checking every day is a little stressful for you, the first step here is to make a reminder on the 15th. On the 15th of the month, are you on track to meet what you need in terms of getting assignments coming in or set up or finished to hit your monthly income goal? And at the beginning of the year, like I said, it's going to be hard and it's going to be stressful and you're not going to do it. But having that reminder on the 15th, am I ready to meet this goal? That makes you say, nope, okay, let me spend the next 2 days pitching. So how do we track the right marketing efforts for us? How do we track and find out over time, you know, after that check on the 15th or if you're doing it every day, whether the marketing efforts that you're doing are the right ones that are bringing you the right results for the least work? And this is really the important thing here, that we don't just want to be, like I said, pitching more. We want to be pitching better. And what that means is that we want to be spending the least time on the pitches that have the most results. Okay? So in terms of magazines, what does that mean? In terms of magazines, it means that you want to build a relationship with an editor, or multiple editors, of course, so that you don't need to spend as much time writing the pitch to that editor, and also so that the editor will start assigning you articles rather than the other way around. And with a lot of bigger magazines, and even small magazines, but a lot of things are decided in-house in an editorial meeting, and then the editor takes those ideas and asks the people that they already know if they want to write them. And that doesn't mean that you can't become one of those people, and you can quite quickly, but it just means that once that you are in with that editor, that there's a lot less time that you need to spend pitching, because the ideas will come to you instead of vice versa. Okay? And so that means that you want to be sending new pitches to get in front of new editors to build new relationships, because you never know which relationships might be better than the ones you already have. You don't know what the pay terms are. You don't know if this magazine actually pays you 15 days after acceptance, and it's like you send in the article and you have the check right away. And those are my favorite types of magazines, and I try to only write for those. But you, if you're unhappy with your income or the editors that you're working with, there's really always somebody else. And it's often not the flashy ones that are going to really take care of you and give you those assignments. Okay, what if we're not looking at magazines? What if we're looking at blogs? How do we track those? So if you are doing the type of travel content marketing pitching we've been talking about for the last couple weeks, it's pretty easy to track those efforts, right? You're finding people, you're writing cold pitches, you're sending them out, you know how many people are replying to you, how many requests for phone calls you get. Those, I mean, I've heard a lot of people tracking those. It's really quite easy to see. The thing is, what happens if you're just applying to things online, and how do you tweak them if they're not working? So here's what I recommend. If you are sending the same pitch, and this also applies if you have a magazine article that is not finding a home, but if you send out the same pitch 5 to 10 times and get no responses at all, then you need to go back and tweak it, okay? And the same thing goes for different marketing efforts, okay? So if you are pitching, say you went on a particular trip, say you went, I'll use this Japan trip that I went on that I use as an example a lot. Say you went on this trip to Japan and you did a lot of very once-in-a-lifetime things and you've been pitching it out and you've pitched 5 or 10 places and you've heard nothing back, then you have to stop and say, are these the right places for this magazine? Did I put enough time into seeing if they had covered Japan recently? Did I put enough time into seeing if the scope of this story was the right thing? So I really recommend 5 or 10 times for the same type of thing. So if it's pitching companies, or if you're applying to jobs online, or if you're pitching the same trip to a couple different magazines, that's the point where you want to stop and ask yourself, is there something I can improve here? Now, if you are very diverse, if you write for magazines, if you have your own blog that you're pitching out for sponsorship, and you also blog for other companies, then you've got a lot of different things. And this is where I find that people become less diversified often, is that if you aren't tracking your metrics, then you're going to keep trying to do all these 3, 4, 5, 7 different hats that you're wearing. But if you're looking at your metrics and you're looking, okay, I've been spending a lot of time pitching sponsorships for my blog because that's what I want to do, but I'm just not getting anywhere with those, then that means it's time to scale back the time that you're spending pitching that and spend your time pitching something more effective. Or, you know, if you're in the position to, and you do have a blog, which is its own business, you can also look at bringing on somebody to help you with those things as well and give them a 50% cut of the sales take. There's a question, is there a spreadsheet to track or an app? There was a really great app about pitching a few years ago that reminded you to follow up on your pitches, which is sadly gone. I personally, with magazine pitches, and actually with a lot of different types of pitches that I do, what I do is as soon as I send the pitch out, I go to my calendar and I mark when I'm going to follow up on that specific pitch. I put it on the day, and I'll usually write whatever it takes for me to remember it. And then that day I'll circle back and I'll follow up on it. And I'll make a reminder for the next time, which is that if I haven't heard back about that pitch, I send it out somewhere else, and I send a different idea to that editor. And what that means is that as I go through the week and the month, you know, I'm seeing how many I have to do multiple times. So I don't have a big master spreadsheet where I'm tracking, you know, exact percentages over time of that. I do have some that I use for other types of pitching. But that's because for me, I see it and I kind of remember and I get a feeling about it. I know a lot of people that have really elaborate spreadsheets, but the one thing that I would recommend is that you make sure that whatever tracking mechanism you're doing is accomplishing its job. So if you are spending a lot of time making this beautiful spreadsheet and really looking at the numbers, is that taking away from just sending another pitch or resending that pitch out? So make sure that whatever type of tracking you're doing is effective, but it allows you to get in and get out and get the information that you need. And I had Alicia let me know that she has designed a freelance planner with a pitch board page with follow-up reminders, which is so fantastic and obviously what we all need. And I just told her to send me the link, and I'm going to share that with you guys all in the chat box. So I'll push that out in a second when I get it from her. So if you have any other questions on setting goals or tracking them or reassessing them, drop that in the chat box. And in the meantime, whoops, we're going to move over less slides than this. We're going to move on to pitching. So pitching more and pitching better, right? Here is the Create Space link for all of you. Check out that planner that Alicia has made. All right, so pitching more and pitching better. I'd love to hear from you guys in the chat box how many pitches, and I ask people this all the time. It's like my, instead of people asking what do you do or like where are you from, I ask people how often they're pitching, it seems. So let me know in the chat box how often you are sending out new pitches of any kind, whether it's for content marketing or for magazines or you're pitching, you know, to do a guest blog post or whatever it is that you personally are focused on pitching. Now, six-figure travel writers, like I said, they pitch often. They pitch more than most people. And when I say more, I really mean a factor, like a factor of 5 or 10. And the thing that I find is not just that they pitch more, but like I said, they're pitching, you know, in a more effective way, but that they're pitching more often. So they're not just sending a higher number of pitches. It's not like they sit down on the first of the month and they send out 25 pitches, although I've been known to do that, and I know a lot of other people who do as well. But they typically have it scheduled regularly in their calendar. And so it's not uncommon that people use Friday as their, they call it the admin day, when they do their invoicing and their pitching. I don't love the idea of having this kind of admin day where you also do your invoicing and your pitching and different things, because I find that pitching is a certain mentality and it really helps to get into it and just do that. So what I recommend is no matter what day it is or what time, that you set aside some time on your calendar that is your time to think about new ideas and about where they fit as a start. Because, you know, writing pitches is a writing task, right? And finding the fit is more of a brainstorming mental task. So if you are somebody who has a huge email file of ideas to pitch, don't worry about setting aside time for idea generation. Set aside time that you're going to pull 5 things out of that file once a week and you're going to write them up. So whichever is your roadblock, whether you feel like you're not pitching because you just don't have ideas, then set aside time every week to go through your trips, to go through magazines, to go through the travel magazine database and find what are the fits, or to generate ideas based on what magazines are looking for. And if you have a huge file of ideas, as I do and I know some people do, and you're still not pitching, but you're great at coming up with ideas, but you're just not doing the writing of the pitch and the sending of the pitch, then mark a time in your calendar every week or even every day to work on it a little bit over the course of the week that you're going to spend on that. And one tip here, you know, pro tip as they say, somebody in a private Facebook group had this really lovely thing that she mentioned the other day that I wanted to share with you all on the topic of pitching better as well as more often. And what she said was this. She said that she's one of these ideaphile people who wasn't getting her ideas out. And so what she did is that every day during the course of the day, as she was coming up with her pitch ideas, rather than just write them down and store them in a folder, she did this neat thing. She wrote them on a post-it, and she stuck them on her desk. And at the end of the day, before she signed off for the day, she had to take that post-it, and she had to transform it into what I call P2, which is the paragraph in your pitch where you're talking about what the article is about, and the format and how it fits with the magazine that you're pitching. So this isn't the lead and it's not the about you paragraph, but she would make sure that while that idea was fresh, when she had just come up with it, she would write that P2. And this had this wonderful result, that once the P2 was written, it would kind of stick around in her head, and then, you know, while she was in the shower or while she was driving, she might think of a great lead. So then she'd write that lead down. And then it's just a function of adding the about her paragraph, which really doesn't take that long. And so she found that she was, even though she was totally swamped with other work, that she was able to get more pitches out and get some acceptances from really great magazines just by forcing herself to take 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes at the end of the day to just sort of close the loop and start the process on each of those pitches. So an interesting conundrum here, and I want to talk about this under pitching more and pitching better. I often find that when I talk to travel writers who do travel writing as their full-time job, but don't necessarily have the income that they would like, that when I ask them why they're not pitching, and I'm totally guilty of this or have been guilty of this, the answer is because they're too busy. But how is that, right? How can you be too busy but not earning enough money? Remember I talked in the very beginning of the webinar about how sustainable travel writing isn't when you have to work a bajillion hours a day. So what often happens is you get in, and I don't want to quite call it a hamster wheel, but you get in this thing where you have some work, you have some clients, you have some relationships with magazines or with website editors, and they give you a lot of work. And the pay is good enough that it sustains you, but it's not necessarily the type of writing that you want to be doing or the outlets you'd like to be published in, or it's just too much work, like you just don't want to be working so many hours. So the solution to all of these problems, even though it puts a little more on your plate in the short term, is to pitch more. It's to have that appointment every week where you have to pitch no matter what. Because, and to quote another writer who I love, you don't have to take every assignment. You can say no. You can say, I can't do it by that day. Can I give it to you later? Just because you are spending time pitching when you have a lot on your plate doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be adding to your plate now. What you're actually doing is you're giving yourself options for the future to say no to the work that's not as great and then start saying yes to the things that will grow your career and grow your income over time. So I know we've talked a lot about pitching on other webinars. If you have other questions about how to pitch more or how to pitch better, drop those in the chat box right now, and we're going to go on to the next slide. So how are these high-income travel writers so fearless? How do they send pitches in 15 minutes rather than 2 hours? How do they send 25 pitches a month? How do they sit down and write 10 pitches a day and send them out? So I think, like I said in the beginning, or when I first started talking about these 5 points, there's this big idea that the people who do big things or who hustle or whatever are different somehow. And I want to use an anecdote of a friend of mine who's very public about these things, so I'm not sort of, you know, doing anything bad by mentioning this. So there's this really close friend of mine, Chris Guillebeau, who has built very much an empire in the last not that many years, like maybe 5-7 years. And he has had multiple New York Times best-selling books. I think, in fact, on his last book tour, Warren Buffett was like a special guest on one of his book stops. So he's kind of a big deal. He runs a really big event every year. He has a daily podcast right now. He's kind of a big deal. And he is totally scared of so many things all the time, about failing his audience, about, you know, about how he's doing in his friendships, about so many things. But he does it anyway. And in fact, he does it because he's scared. It's almost like he feels like, if I'm afraid of this thing, you know, if I'm afraid that people won't like it or whatever, I have to, you know, get more options out, get more things out to get more feedback back. So that's one way that you can kind of set it up for yourself. If you're afraid of not hearing back, send more pitches. Then you're more likely to hear back. But there's 3 reasons in particular that I feel like people get stuck, that I don't see these high-income travel writers suffering from. And so I want to go over those. So people are afraid of doing it right. And when we did this in the DC event, I did a little overview of these are the 3 things that you need in a pitch. But I've already talked about it right now. You need this lead where you grab the attention of the editor. You need that middle paragraph where you tell them what you want to write, what's going to be included in the article, and why it's a fit for the publication. And then you need that 3rd paragraph where you say why you're the right person to write this particular piece for this particular magazine, and nothing else. So if you're afraid of pitching correctly, follow those steps. That's all you need to know. And the thing is, like, I think that we get really hung up on this afraid of doing it right because we think there's not going to be any more chances or that we're going to burn ourselves with an editor or something like that. And there is a writer based out of Boulder, Jamie Moy, and she did a pitching workshop a little while ago, and she shared all of her pitches from when she was super new with this whole conference of a couple hundred people. And, like, they weren't the end of the world, but they weren't perfect. They weren't the type of things that you share in a workshop to show people how to pitch. And now she is a freelance frequent contributor to Men's Journal and, you know, wins awards all the time. So nobody started out doing perfect. a pitch that's sent out is 100% better than a pitch that is never sent out. So if you're afraid of doing it, you need to just do it anyway. And I know that's like no balm on your fears, but you just have to start doing it anyway. There's some other things that there's different solutions for, though. If you're afraid of the time it's going to take, so if you're afraid that pitching takes you 2 or 3 hours, so how can you send more pitches? Start setting a timer and make yourself get something done in that timer. 10 minutes is a really good timer to set because, you know, if you have to do 2 10-minutes, you don't feel too bad, and 10 minutes is enough that you can just sprint and just focus on it and not get burnt out. So I recommend starting with a 10-minute timer. Anytime you're writing something that you feel scared about, whether it's a pitch or now you have a feature assignment and you don't know how to write the lead, just set a timer for 10 minutes and do it. Now, the fear of rejection is different. So fear of rejection is not quite so much like fear of failure. When you're being afraid of rejection as a writer, you're afraid of getting that email back that tells you no, as in, no, you are not a good writer. No, you're not a good person. No, we don't want you. But that's not what those emails say. When somebody takes the time to write you back an email saying no, they're actually saying, you're not that bad. I know it seems sort of backwards, but I say this, you know, editing a website now myself and having been an editor in the past. When somebody responds to your email, they're opening a door. And sometimes bad things, like crazy people, can come through that door. Somebody might send a pitch and they seem totally sane, and you say, no, this doesn't really fit. And then somebody calls you at your desk every day for the next, or not every day, once a week for the next 5 years to tell you about this same article that they pitched you and how you really should accept it. This is an actual story that I've heard from an actual travel editor. I'm not making this up. So when an editor writes back to you to say no in whatever way, shape, or form, they're actually saying, you can write me back. You can send me some more pitches. So don't be afraid of rejection because it's actually a great thing. So if you are afraid just of doing it right, you got to do it anyway. If you're afraid of how long it's going to take, which is a little bit of a perfection fear, just set a timer and do a quick and dirty thing. And if you're afraid of rejection, don't forget it's actually a good thing. All right, we're getting close to the end of our time, so I'm going to do this last point and then quickly go through some ways that you can incorporate this into your life. But if any of you need to go, thank you so much for joining us. So this last point here, are you dedicating time to learning about how to be better? And you're all here, so obviously you are. But the thing is that I've really seen this chasm between the people who just read the same travel blogs. Like they want to quit their job and become a travel writer, but they've started a blog and now they just keep reading the same little small circle of travel blogs, and they don't go read travel magazines. You know, they don't go sit down and read, you know, all of the articles and essays that won the NACHA or the SATW travel writing awards that year. They don't dedicate themselves to learn as if they were getting their own personal MFA in travel writing. And the people that really do make a stellar income and successful and sustainable career, they don't say yes to every opportunity to learn, but they say yes to the opportunities to learn that are going to give them even the smallest little thing to grow their income. And this is an interesting thing that I've seen. I've seen people will spend a really big chunk of change on a resource that a lot of it might be something that they already know, because they know if they get 1 or 2 good tips from that, then they'll get more articles, and they know what that's worth to them. It's worth, you know, another $2,000 a month or something like that. So I really recommend that you look at investing not just your money but your time specifically in learning how to be better, whether that's as a writer, as somebody pitching, in your marketing writing, whether that's, you know, for your own pitches or on your own website. But this goes back to what we said in the third point, which was about analytics, right? So if you are not achieving what you want to be achieving, there's a reason. And you need to figure out which of the very many factors in what you're doing can be contributing to that. And the only way to do that is to learn what better looks like and then to go back and apply it to the metrics you've been tracking and see where you can do better. So on that note, what can you do right now to replicate the success of these high-income travel writers? All right. So If you do not already have a recurring writing gig, and I know I've heard from some people in the chat box, you know, that they edit books or they do some blogs, but they're not really earning as much as they can. If you don't have a recurring writing gig of some kind that pays 50% of your goal income, make that your number one priority. Like, don't spend time pitching these beautiful essays that you would love to write for these amazing publications, because that's less important right now than having something that you can safely know is going to pay your bills while still allowing you to do some travel writing doing that. So that should be your number one priority. If you do not have something that is not filing at a legal office or something else like that, but if you do not have a travel writing thing that meets at least 50%, I would say 60 or 70 if you have kids, but at least 50% of your travel writing income goal, make that your number one thing. And like I said, we had just done the month of travel content marketing webinars. That's a great thing to go to. And if you want to write for magazines, I recommend doing this by building relationships with editors. So pick editors to pitch that you know you'll have a lot of ideas for, that they're in your geographic area, that they're in a niche you know well, and focus on building relationships with those editors. So pitch them once, follow up with them, then send them another pitch, then follow up on that, and I guarantee, like I literally guarantee, by the third time, that editor will most certainly have gotten back to you in one way or another. And then you have that opportunity to say, oh, I'm sorry, that didn't work. What are you looking for? Or is there some geographic area you've been looking for a story for that you haven't gotten that I can help you out with? Okay? So number two, make sure you have an income goal, because you can't get somewhere if you don't have a goal. You just keep wandering. So make sure you have an income goal. Break it down by month, and then break it down by day. And either, like I said, stick it in your actual physical or Google or phone or whatever calendar as a little reminder at the end of the day saying, hey, did you earn this much? Or just on the 15th of the month, make yourself a little reminder that says, am I on my way to earning this goal? If not, I need to drop everything and spend some time doing some marketing. Now, the third point, if you already have the Travel Magazine database, and I know a bunch of you do, use that. Use it specifically to come up with ideas first, not to plug your ideas into the things that magazines are looking for, but just spend like 5 minutes a day cruising some entries and trying to see what ideas you can come up with really based in what the magazines are looking for. Now, if you don't have the Travel Magazine database, you can just do it with real travel magazines. You can go to Barnes & Noble or Borders. I can never remember which one is the one that closed. You can go to your local bookstore and just spend 15 minutes, an hour, whatever you can afford to spend time-wise, cruising through some magazines and just brainstorming ideas based on the magazine. And then send those pitches. If you're afraid of doing it right, do it anyway. If you're afraid of how long it's going to take, set a timer. If you're afraid of rejection, be super excited when you get that rejection and say, thanks so much for getting back to me. Here's another pitch. And then, like I said, another thing that you can put in your calendar really easily, or I like to do it in the morning when I first wake up and I don't feel like getting out of bed yet, is to read about freelance writing as a business, or to read about writing and read good writing. Whether you need to work more on your marketing, your business side, or more on improving your writing, choose one of those two things. And so with that, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really a pleasure, as always, chatting with you guys. And feel free to email any questions to me at questions@dreamoftravelwriting.com.